Today we're going to talk about Senate District 24. And State Senator Jesse Green is seeking re-election. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
Have you moved that over a little bit in front of you there, yes, so sir. Everybody can hear you. And also his challenger, Margaret Liston. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
All right. We do have, again, the district, as I put it out there, was it was a whole different district when Senator Green first ran. It was just Boone, Greene County, and up into Webster, I think, and a little in Hamilton.
Yep. And so after redistricting, we lost Hamilton and Webster, a quarter of Webster, and we picked up Guthrie and a quarter of Dallas. So that was a change.
A big change there, and still a sizable area to travel.
63,000 people, though. That's the main thing.
First of all, your decision to run again, obviously you were successful in the last session with some of the things you had been pursuing when you went to the legislature. Want to continue that, I'm guessing?
Certainly. It takes a few years to adjust and get used to any work change, and this was definitely a big work change, especially post-COVID. Just a lot of big issues to tackle and whatnot, and so it did take a few years to get comfortable at the Capitol and to know how the place works. But I have grown so much through this experience as a person and as a legislator. I'm still the youngest Republican in the state Senate, which is kind of surprising. Representative Carter Norman, he's also the youngest House member in the House. So there's just a lot of good young energy here. I'm honored to be the local government chair in the Senate. It's pretty rare for somebody to become a policy chair this quickly in their legislative careers. So just a huge honor to have that position. Okay. So I look forward to another term if elected.
Margaret, mm-hmm. on the city council in Ogden, and made a decision to try to move to a higher position here. What brought this about? A little bit, again, you're retired, so.
Yes. Well, I've been on the city council in my 21st year. I felt that the people's voices were not being heard. Mm-hmm. When you have a lot of people coming, reaching out to our legislative representatives and saying, no, this is really going to affect our families, our children, you know, our school systems, and they were not heard. So yeah. I feel we need better representation in that aspect.
So we started our campaign then, and
yes.
Going around. So what have you heard going around, visiting with the same folks and hearing the same kind of things, or are different? Because things change.
Yes.
You know, basically, if the beginning of your campaign, the end of your campaign could be two different things.
True. I still am hearing a lot of dissatisfaction with underfunding our public schools and the dismantling of AEA. That is still broad across mm-hmm. the district. I'm also, though, there's people that are really struggling in our smaller communities. And that is at times very heartbreaking to hear some of their stories. I just would like to see us do a little bit better for those smaller communities in our district.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to be done.
Jesse, I know you were heavily involved in the education part, especially on the voucher side, because that was one of the things early on you had said, I'm a big supporter of this. We needed to make that happen. I know you were one of the leaders on that. That is pretty well in place. And what would you think as far as the process so far? Is it working the way you had thought, or is this one we're still watching play out?
Well, I think there's quite a few different angles to this topic. One is when I first got elected, my phone would go off the hook about issues such as books or different things that were being taught within the public school system, and that consumed a lot of my time. But now in this post-school choice world, my phone doesn't go off the hook as often because people know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say, hey, find the school that best fits you and your values and your thinking, and so. I think that in itself shows the success of the program. When we as legislators and public servants, we want to create a policy that creates a more civil society, and we want a happy taxpayer. And I think as a result of this, I think everybody is able to find those educational options that best suits them. Iowa is just so vast in our educational options. We have about 30,000 homeschool students, 30,000 private school students, and about 500 and some thousand public school students. My suspicion is as this program continues to roll out, some of those homeschool families are going to come out of the woodwork and start starting up some private schools of their own. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how the educational landscape changes across Iowa. This past year, you heard a lot about this closure of Orient-Maxburg. And we got to keep in mind there's 328 school districts across the state of Iowa. So to have one close is not a complete shocker. When you dig a little bit deeper under the surface, Orient-Maxburg, they had a huge demographic of students that were open enrolled out of the school. That kind of tells you something, that Orient-Maxburg wasn't a healthy school system. Meanwhile, in the private school system, you have 13 new private schools across the state of Iowa. You don't hear about that in the media. They don't highlight that topic. We got new teachers that are moving into our district now because of the increase in opportunity in our districts. We have three private schools in our district, and this has been so transformative for them. So I'm excited about this. Public schools have I've been largely happy or content with some of the changes. Keep in mind, for each private school student that goes to a private school, the public school gets to keep $1,200 of their property tax revenue, even though that they're not teaching that student. So financially, those schools are in really good shape.
And you did some teacher salary increases last time, too.
Certainly. Last year was the largest teacher pay increase in Iowa history. We now have the fifth highest paid teachers in the nation. And so there's just so many campaign promises that I had 4 years ago that I've successfully been able to deliver this past year based on that that bill.
That's for beginning teachers. I know some districts are over that limit already that was set, but does additional funding keep coming to that as they keep going up the ladder if they've been there, or is it just to get them started?
We're going to have another conversation this next session about what this looks like going forward, but I can promise you I'm going to fight as much as possible to make sure that we keep funding that aspect of the teacher pay increase. But going forward, it's I'm excited because if you're going to lower class size, which I think is the number one thing that we need to do in education, I think it's an all of the above approach with education. We need more opportunities, more teachers, higher pay, and I think we're getting there.
Margaret, I know you would like to keep public money with public schools.
I would, very much so. So you did not quite answer his question. So the teacher increase was just for 1 year, is that correct?
The paraeducator increase was for 1 year, and that's going to have to be a conversation that goes forward. As far as the starting teacher pay increase, that's going to continue going forward.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
All right. No, I am for funding our public schools. I think it's very important. We are taking public tax dollars out of the general fund to the private schools with no transparency, no accountability. Teachers don't have to be licensed. And we have 42 counties with no private schools. We have 24 counties that only have one. If you have one school in the county, that makes transportation an issue. But 10 counties out of 99 are receiving the majority of the voucher money. That's going to be bigger urban areas. Mm-hmm. So I see this as hurting our public schools. You want smaller class sizes? Then let's put our money into our public schools. Our teachers are having to do more with less, and that's hard. They can't do their job with the vouchers. What do I want to say?
Create some challenges, I'm sure.
It does. It does. Yes, it does. I'll just leave it there for now.
Could I say one thing with that? I appreciate the arguments, and I appreciate that we're really thoroughly talking about this issue because we want good policy at the end of the day. But I think we can't miss sight of the big picture that of the entire education spending, The ESA program represents 2.4% of the entire education spending that we do in the state of Iowa. And I think when we have this conversation, we lose track that on average, we spend $19,500 per student when you add up property tax, state dollars, and federal dollars. And so I think what we need to do better on both sides of the aisle is educating our constituents on what the real cost of education is so we can have a healthier conversation about what we need to do going forward.
I have another question. Yeah. Gwen, okay, you brought up that these kids are going to, well, you may not have said it, they're going into the private schools. So if they don't stay at the private schools and they come out and don't finish the school year, so does that money go back to the public schools?
So the way it's set up is that the payments are 50% up front in the first semester and 50% on the for the second semester. But keep in mind, like on the first year that a student leaves a public school, even the state supplemental aid stays with that public school in the first year, knowing that there could be that changeover midstream, and because maybe the parents aren't going to be happy with the private school environment and then want to go back to the public school. So, that's a great question.
So that money does follow that student back to public school?
So depending which semester, it's prorated as well, depending on... when that transfer happens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Okay.
So somewhere along the line, it follows them.
Yes.
The one question I wanted to ask is, I don't know if Margaret's heard any comments about it or anything like that, but we do have a private company that handles the AAS money and stuff like that. Have we had any issues going on with that? Has everything worked out smoothly, I guess? Because obviously they're in it to make money, too.
Sure. Well, this company has done other states as well. There's a few companies that do it, but this is the most reputable and most proven company to do it. So I know Auditor Sands brought up some question marks and stuff like that with that, and I appreciate that. But it's proven that the cost has been way more effective than other alternatives.
Okay. Well,
with this company, the starting fee was $267,000. That came out that there was additional fees that were added on top, and that went up to a little over $682,000. So by 2027, it's predicted that the bill for Odyssey to run this program will be over $852,000 a year. So
I want you to start in on AEA, is the Area Education Agencies, because I know we know people that have been greatly concerned about it. Some things are getting worked out. Others, it's a very controversial topic.
Yes, it is. AEA is a consortium, or was a consortium, of services for all public schools. So this was an equal playing field. It was equal across all the schools. Didn't matter if you were rural or urban. Services were available, and they were paid for. So, for example, we'll take Ogden School District. Mm-hmm. Say they try to anticipate what their needs are going to be when they're setting their budget, but you cannot anticipate everything. So say you have a child that comes in that's blind, and you need support for that student. You can call AEA and tell them what you need, and within about 24 hours, they had services for you. Now, here's an example. They had a student that needed a curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So they're reaching out to get this curriculum for this student. That curriculum is going to cost $900, but they don't know that that's going to be the correct curriculum for that student. Whereas AEA would have come in, assessed that student, and helped the teacher and the student have what they need. Okay. They also helped the teacher teach that curriculum. They helped educate the teachers how to be better teachers with these students. They also helped with their continuing education credits. Mm-hmm. So AEA is a big deal. It's very important, and I feel that in the end, I mean, I don't think we see the fallout so much this year. I think next year is going to be very telling for what's missing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jesse, you were a supporter of the work that was done going into AEAs. Again, you didn't want to see the whole thing going right away, but you did feel that it was time to have some restructuring and some, again, take a look at the process.
Well, I think we have to remember that back in around 2011, 2012, there was a task force that came and gave us some recommendations to the legislature, and the legislature did nothing. I mean, it's a very sensitive topic. It's a very politically heated topic, so it was a lot easier just to kick the can down the road, so to speak, and not deal with this issue. But taxpayers elected us to make tough choices and to study these things out and to be accountable for their dollars. There's over $500 million that goes into AEAs. To put that in perspective, we spend more, about $100 million more on AEAs than we do for our entire transportation budget. That's just mind-boggling to me. But it is what it is. We want to make sure that our students are well taken care of, whatever the cost. But we are the only state, we're the only state prior to this that funded the AEAs directly and required that the schools get their services from the AEA. And in a system like that, over time, it's going to create more bloat and it's going to create more bureaucracy, more employees and stuff like that. And over the decades, that's exactly what's happened. And when you talk to the people that started the AEAs, they never dreamt that it would become the bloated bureaucracy that it became. And so the easiest solution to that is to give control, local control, to the schools and to the customers as to how they spend their dollars. So in the first year, the dollars that the schools get a choice on is media and ed services, and then some of the dollars goes to the Department of Education to set up some oversight there. That was one of the recommendations I was given back in 2011, is that we needed more oversight from the Department of Education. When this is fully implemented, 90% of the special education dollars are going to stay with the AEAs, 90% of them, and then 10% will be given to the schools for them to use as they wish. And so in between this time frame, and we do have a task force that's going to come back to us and give us some more insight as to what they think we need to do. I think we're being very careful with this. This is a very sensitive topic. We're talking about special education. We want the best for our students. And keep in mind that the federal government had us as a special needs state as far as they might have made the changes for us if we didn't make some changes because they were seeing that there was potentially a problem that was occurring in the state of Iowa. So we needed to act, and we did, and I think the special education students will get better services. And keep in mind, my last point is I never had one superintendent reach out to me and say, don't do this. I had a lot of superintendents that were neutral, and I had some superintendents that were adamant, we need to make a change. And so that right there tells me that the professionals on the ground, I think they know what's best for their needs, and we delivered that for them.
Well, I think it would have been much better instead of having the task force after the fact to have gone ahead and had all the stakeholders and study it, then come back. If there was too much bloat, I mean, in the hospital, if our expenditures were too high, well, then we set back and took a look. It's like, okay, are we top heavy in management? Well, we need to make some changes. We need to make some cuts. I think that would have been better before just going ahead and dismantling, to have studied it and had them bring back recommendations. Or something else I want to say. I'll leave it there.
On the AEAs. Let's talk school safety next, because you now have the Perry School District.
Yep.
And again, that was the one that attracted all the attention right away at the beginning of the year. Unfortunately, it was. But again, so one of the things I noticed out of here was no charges from the Dallas County Attorney. Opted not to bring any charges, and I know there are some that feel that somebody should be charged for something. To me, when I'm looking at some of the reports and some of the things, the information you're giving out, there were some definite signs, especially mental health related signs, that either were not followed up on or were missed somehow or other. But I'll start with Margaret on school safety.
Okay. So. Well, I don't think arming teachers was a solution to the problem. I do believe we need to have more mental health services in our schools. I don't think we have enough. We don't have enough mental health services throughout the state. I think the mental health system is broken, and we really need to work hard to repair it. I think we need to work on some common sense laws. My husband and I have guns. We don't hunt. We target shoot occasionally. We keep ours locked up. So I think we need to work on safe storage. I think that's very important. Also, I think if we spent some time increasing our infrastructure for our schools, that would be beneficial. And red flag laws. We have some laws. We have background checks. I think we could build those a little bit better. Resource officers. I know that it's not possible for all schools to afford resource officers. In Ogden, what we have done, our police chief, we have contracted with the high school, the school district, and our police chief spends a certain amount of hours each week between the two schools, and it's a E-28 agreement. Mm-hmm. It's working very well. I know the county has done a lot with drills, going to the different schools so that they know exactly the layouts of the school. I don't know. I think we could think out of the box a little bit for some of these smaller communities. You know, is there something we can do with the county sheriff's department to be making some rounds? You know, I don't know. I think there's potential there.
Okay. Jesse, your thoughts? Because I know you were involved with, the bill to arm teachers, and Phil did usher that through, I think it was. And again, it's back up to the teachers in the school districts what they're going to do.
Well, first off, I would like to highlight this was probably the most stressful period of my legislative 4 years was during the Perry situation. It was right at the start of last session, and of course, the AEA bill was on my desk at the same time, and so I'll never forget that moment. But anyway, you're right that Phil Thompson managed the bill, and he did a fabulous job on it. The bill. What I think is kind of interesting with how the conversation went with the bill is it wasn't necessarily about arming teachers or whatever. It was about the insurance conversation. We have one insurance company that insures over 90% of the school districts. That in itself is a problem that we continue need to look at. So the question was about immunity to schools and teachers in this situation. Not every school district is the same. Not every school district has city police nearby or county police. And so you saw kind of a need for this up in Northwest Iowa, where you have large school districts sizes and not as much police presence. And so they're trying to think outside of the box of how they can secure themselves. So that's what kind of drove this bill forward is, again, about local control, allowing local schools to make decisions for themselves as in their best interest. Also, there's another bill to loosen up some property tax dollars to go towards school security. Another common sense measure to help increase revenue to schools and options for them to make sure that their schools are secure. So each school has to go through an assessment, and the schools need to do the best that they can to meet those assessments. And I can guarantee you that funding is not the issue. As school resource officers, we're all in agreement that we could use more of them. But in all these topics, there's a workforce shortage, and there's a shortage of security officers as well. So So I was really proud with how we responded with that. We helped Perry out specifically with a Perry bill that would allow them to use their management levy to pay for retention bonuses to teachers to help keep teachers there in Perry. So again, there's always going to be more work to do on this. Definitely mental health issues. I'm proud of some of the legislation that we passed to make a telehealth available in schools. We also dealt with the payments for telehealth to make sure that it was equivalent to in-person counseling. And so we definitely need more psychiatrists out there. And so we also provided a loan forgiveness program through to help encourage providers to go to rural mm-hmm. Iowa. So we definitely need, have more work to do.
Yeah. As you heard the reports, did you feel that some signs were missed or not followed up on?
I didn't see the reports mm-hmm. very closely, but one thing's for sure is what little I did hear, there was definitely a lot of red flags that went ignored, and I'm not sure there's probably a little bit of responsibility that goes around to a lot of people on that.
Yeah. I would like to just touch on the insurance, EMC.
Yeah.
EMC does insure a lot, well, yes, a lot of schools, but it also insures communities under 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. Because small towns, you know, we don't have a lot of employees. We review that every year to see if that's what we still want.
It's a challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge. But I don't think saying that it's not right, that this insurance company, just because it covers the schools, it covers a lot of small communities as well. And it keeps that price down for these smaller communities. We can't compete with Ames or Cedar Rapids for insurance. So it does provide, this insurance company provides a good service to small communities.
Well, I do think, yeah, and I'm not attacking the insurance company. Good for them. They obviously are doing a good job to have 95% of the market. But it does seem like that private schools seem to have more options when it comes to insurance availability. And so I just think that's odd when private schools have just as much, if not more, options than public schools. So again, it's about immunity. We're not forcing anybody to do anything. If a teacher doesn't want to carry a gun, they don't have to. If a school board decides not to, again, it's all about local control.
Yeah, I want to stay with insurance for a second because I haven't hit on this with anybody, really.
Sure.
You get your insurance bill, did you? You see what everybody, that's and the big issue has been that we've got some sizable increases driven by a lot of events, and I'm sorry if we get another hurricane. Here comes another red star that's going to be parked on there, too. But those are challenges. Again, I know that it comes to the legislature. You've got big insurance companies in Des Moines that are lobbying. So how do we, I mean, for many people, it's getting very, very difficult just to insure their homes, their cars.
Yeah.
What options do we have?
Well, most of the time, government intervention is not the option. They usually create more problems. But I'm always going to be a free market guy and whatever. But I do see, one thing I am concerned about as individuals is I do think most of the world just circles around insurance and almost like insurance directs all of their life. And it's like, I wish people took more personal responsibility to insure them, like be self-insured and take care of their bodies and whatever. And of course, we all have unfortunate circumstances and you have to insure for that. But it is just eye-opening how many fears there are and that people have about insurance, and it's just to me, it's upside down.
Well, I've had some experience after derecho. You know, own the building in the barbershop in Ogden, and you know, I had a 500 deductible. The insurance was very reasonable. I needed a new roof after mm-hmm. derecho. Man, the deductible went up to 5,000, and the premium doubled. And it was like, no, to put a new roof on that little building wouldn't have even cost 5,000. So no, if I'm correct, I think each state sets their own insurance
limits?
I know they have, each state has some say in the insurance, but I'm not quite sure what. I think insurance is just out of the roof.
I think you're going to start seeing a shift of people deciding not to have insurance on things that they don't have to have insurance on, and start rethinking how they view their properties and how they're going to take care of their properties. Because you're right, it's out of control, and there comes to a point that you just got to change your strategy.
Yeah. Well, I'll just share this story. I was out knocking on doors with a candidate for county supervisor in Greene County. And we stopped at this door and visiting with this lady, homeowner. And, oh my goodness, pretty soon she's in tears. Well, they canceled her insurance because she wasn't doing enough. Well, she just put a brand new roof on a year ago. She lost five family members in 5 years. She's just defeated.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she can't afford the insurance, and she has no insurance right now. I fortunately met a person at one of our meet and greets, and she had information where a company in Des Moines will just do a flat rate to cover your house. So I called her and made sure she had that information. But it's just climate change, I think, is having a huge impact. And I feel like we are helping pay for some of these disasters in Florida and the fires.
Yeah.
I don't know what the solution is.
I don't either. We started a long time ago with a lot of people starting our mutual insurance companies out there, and had some really good ones started here in Boone County. And, you know, and over time, they were either absorbed or it got to the point where damages were getting hard to deal with. So, but that's a whole nother thing to work on there. Let's talk about something that I know that a lot of people like to talk about is taxes and tax reform. And so we've done a number of different things. First of all, I want to talk, let's talk a little bit about the income tax, the flat tax. I know, Jesse, the governor wanted to push out. You had some reservations, didn't want to go too far too fast, want to see how things play out with that. Are you comfortable with what you're seeing? And again, some of the reserves, some of the surplus that the state had built up is going to be reduced. We know that.
We were actually rated for the second year in a row number one for fiscal responsibility in the nation. And so a lot of credit to Governor Reynolds for her leadership on that. And the reason that I'm a little bit hesitant on the income tax going too fast with eliminating the income tax, because I think there's something that we could do to buy down some of the educational dollars on property taxes, which is over 50% of the property tax bill. And I really feel for our local officials, city council councilmen and women and county supervisors, where they get all the heat for their property tax expense bills from their constituents, but in reality they're only responsible for half of it. And so that's why I'm a little hesitant on moving fast. So we rank in the bottom 10 when it comes to property taxes. We're ranked about average when it comes to sales tax, and now we're in the top 10 for income. And so maybe we can utilize some of the general funds to buy down some of that educational liability. But in order to do that, we need to loosen up some of the silos on the educational funding, make school boards more responsible for how they spend their dollars, so that the voters can either reward or hold accountable the right people that they need to hold accountable to. So, we're the number one state to retire now, largely in part because we eliminated the retirement income tax and the quality of our health care. So, very proud of what we're doing, but there's more work that needs to be done.
Margaret,
well,
start out on
first
the income
off,
tax.
First off, we are not ranked number one in the state to retire. We were last year, but we have moved down to ninth now, and that is due to cost of living, property taxes, and homeowners insurance. So that's what knocked us down. With the tax, I do agree with Jesse. We need to take a step back. I think this is being reduced a little bit too fast. I think we need to see where the chips are going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
I do know in 23, the revenue, the state revenue, was down 89.5 million, or 0.9% decrease. For 24 actual, but into fiscal year 25 estimate, they're figuring 516.9 million revenue decrease, which is a negative 5.3%. And I just heard that the estimate for the fiscal year 25-26 is going to be down, potentially down another 580.2 million, which is a negative 6.39%. So our revenue is decreasing. I just don't want to see us keep taking taxes down until we know we're going to have enough revenue to meet all our, you know, programs, our education. I just think we need to step back.
Yeah, well, so with that, I mean, we had another $2 billion surplus this past year. We have over $5 billion in reserves and surpluses. So, like, I've been accused of hoarding money, and then I've heard a few Democrats that have said we're going to go broke in a couple years. And I'm kind of confused, like, what some of the pushback is. But the reality is we need more to decrease the tax liability. It's just the reason I want to hold back is to make sure that we pull the right levers at the right time. And so at the end of the day, when we overpay for our services, we need to make sure that the taxpayers get that back, because they know how to spend their dollars more better than we do.
I want to shift off that income to the property tax, because I know we did some property tax reform, and it's gradually coming online, if you will. And I know you had said, let it play out. Let's see. I'm talking to Senator Green here. He said, let's leave it. Let's not go right away, start adding on right away until we start to see how some of this is coming together. You know, one of the big things that drove it last time, I think, is we saw just this huge amount of valuation, the big increase in valuation, which just scared a lot of people, because they equate that to increased taxes. We know that we're going to see valuations going up again this year, or the next cycle for the assessors to send out those new valuations. It's going up because what people are spending to buy and live in is going up. It's all based on that. That's the formula we use. The rollback on some of the taxes in the state, again, people think you can go in and automatically make changes in property tax. We know that it's way too complicated to do that. It takes time to work your way through it. Are you comfortable where we're at right now, seeing how this plays out? Do you think there are some other changes that can be coming down the road?
Certainly. My number one concern is people on fixed incomes, the retirees, and that's why I was really proud of the income tax elimination on retirees in Iowa. But also on the property tax front, I'd be a huge fan of freezing property tax at age 65 and above for our retirees, because there's nothing that's more heartbreaking than when you hear somebody that's retired that's afraid of not being able to live in their home anymore just because of the property taxes. So secondly, one thing I would like to defend is the assessors. The assessor's job is to assess properties. They don't spend money. And sometimes in this conversation, I've heard a lot of anger that's been given towards assessors, and I don't think that's the right direction. We have a lot of checks and balances in place to make sure that our assessments are done appropriately. At the end of the day, it's about spending. And so there's a huge concern from local governments when we made that big change here a couple years ago. And whenever there's change, it changes hard. But most of us had a feeling that after 1 year of budgeting, going through the budgeting process, that they would feel more comfortable with it. And I think that's what you've seen play out. And in some cases, they've eliminated some services that they needed to eliminate a long time ago as a result of that change. And going forward, I'd be a fan of trying to cap how much their budgets can grow in a single year without going to the voters for a vote. I'm a fan of that type of process. Lastly, as chair of local government, I see a lot of different situations on the local government level. And usually when it, what I think Iowa has a lot more of than other states is usually with public safety. And so you see a lot of duplications of services across the state with that. And that's a very sensitive conversation. If the town of Ogden or Madrid was deciding whether or not to get rid of their police force, so that's going to be a tough fight, and that's going to divide the community as well. But nevertheless, I think the data does show that we have lots of public service across the state of Iowa. I'm not advocating that any of it should be gone. I'm just advocating that towns think about trying to partner with the sheriffs a little bit more than what they're doing to help help with their budgets. But
it's coming off the county side on the sheriffs, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if they need additional personnel for that, we're still looking at property tax there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because basically it's off the general.
And another thing that just came up that that I'm trying to pay close attention to is the federal government wants us to make some changes with our lead pipes and getting rid of of our lead pipes. That's going to affect our local governments. And so I think we're going to have to make some sort of appropriation from the state level to help apply for some of these grants and make it easier for local governments to make those changes. But I've gotten quite a few emails about lead pipes.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, the letters will be coming out, folks. I'll tell you. And it's basically, it's the first letter to say, you know, you have lead pipes. Anyway, we'll get into another story on that down the road. But, Margaret, wanted property taxes, because you, at the city level, had to deal with this.
Yes, yes. And property taxes do cover a lot of expenses for your community. We are always very conscious of, when we're doing our budget, that we try to keep our taxes or our levy low. Mm-hmm. You know, back in 2008, you know, it was tough. We had to take the levy up a little bit. We have brought that back down to, I think, $8.10. And we have stayed right there. That's a... property tax is a very emotional discussion topic. Outdoor knocking. There are elderly, as Jesse, mm-hmm. you know, seniors that they're worried they can't pay the tax, mm-hmm. the property taxes. And thank goodness, you know, I've been with Penny and she's like, well, you know, here's what you do, and guided them to the courthouse to see if they can have some assistance. But it's a fine line, I think, with the property tax.
I know big effort was put into getting seniors to sign up for the credit, the senior credit, not your homestead credit,
no.
which you should already be taking care of.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the senior credit. But there are still a lot of people just didn't quite understand what was going on with it. They thought they were just going to be handed a check and stuff like that. No, it comes off your property taxes. So still a learning experience, I think.
For sure. No, one last thought when it comes to property tax, I'll never forget when Governor DeSantis came into the state, and that was so much fun traveling with him around the state and seeing his perspective coming from Florida. And he saw right away, he's like, you guys have so much local government. He didn't say it in a negative way or a positive. It was just one of his observances that we have so much local government in Iowa. Well, that's one reason why we have a lot higher property tax. And so so we just have to ask ourselves, like, how can we help the situation out? And again, the big thing that we can do, I think, from the state level is look at property tax reform from the education side. And when half your property tax goes to education, that's where the big conversation has to take place. And I think we're in a fiscally good spot to have a conversation of how can we give more local flexibility and accountability and maybe help buy down some of those dollars.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, I don't agree with cutting public funds. You know, we have most of our kids go to public school. We need to give them the education they deserve to grow and go on to become well-adjusted, educated, you know, if mm-hmm. they want to go to college or trade
sure.
school. I just am opposed to, we've underfunded our public schools for over a decade. And it shows, you know, you can't keep up with the competitiveness, you know, the cost. You know, our inflation goes up and the cost, we all feel that cost. Mm-hmm. And if you don't give that into the public schools, well, they're stuck here and they're trying to buy what they need at a higher cost, but they're not being supplemented for that. So no, I would not be for cutting that at all.
No, I'm not advocating for cutting. Yeah. Cutting. I'm advocating for buying down, transferring dollar for dollar from the general fund to the property tax. But lastly, the last point I would have to make: the last time education was actually cut was by Democrats in 2011 by the tune of 10%. So I like to throw that out there.
Yeah. So. You just throw it out there. You just throw all you want.
It's not your fault.
I'm sure a lot of people won't agree with you. When he said about the police department, Ogden did have three police officers, and it seemed like we'd just get them up and get them running. Yeah. We'd have them a year or two, and Boone would hire them.
That's okay. Boone's get hired in Des Moines, so.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, that's just the way it is. So here a couple of years ago, I think, we decided to contract with the sheriff's department. And we eliminated that third position, which it did come down to be more cost effective to have an agreement with the county sheriff's department than actually having a third police officer. So those things, yes.
You're there.
And a lot of communities, Pilot Mountain, Boxholm, that's what they depend on, is the county deputies coming through their communities.
I wanted to talk a little bit about economic development. I could go on a lot more different things, too. But let's talk a little bit about economic development. The state, different people have different thoughts about it. You have these large companies coming in, and they get pretty good incentive package from the state to locate here, and they are here. And I'm talking about like Google and Amazon. They come in and build the big places and take up a lot of resources. But again, do they have that many employees working? Those are the things that you have to keep wondering about. So economic development, that the way the state is using it, they've been pretty aggressive with it, but I think they also take their time on selecting how things are going. Are you comfortable with some of the things that they are doing at the state level? Do you think there should be some more oversight changes?
I think there could be some more oversight changes. The fertilizer plant that's out on the eastern side of the state, a lot of money went to that, to build that plant, as for the farmers, for a co-op to help keep the prices down. Well, I don't know if at the federal level, if she's made her decision, if the Koch brothers get to purchase that. Mm-hmm. Well, you have a small group of, it's a monopoly. Mm-hmm. And I think we should be paying closer attention to that.
Okay.
Ed Tyson. A lot of money was given there for upgrades, and they're gone.
Yep.
So,
okay. Jesse, your thoughts?
Well, it's a very broad topic, but overall, I mean, that's the way it is, that we have to give incentives to get companies to come. Every state is in that bidding process to get those incentives. But from the 30,000 foot view, we have some of the cheapest housing in the nation. That's something that's good, a low cost of living. But we have a net migration into the state of 2,500 people. Illinois has lost population. Minnesota has lost population. We can guess as to what that is, but I'm sure it's a combination of better tax climate, potentially school choice, especially when in Davenport, Mason City, and Council Bluffs, when you can have $7,800 follow your student into whatever educational environment, that's a big incentive for families to move into the state. So that's going to help our workforce. Companies are going to look at that and think that's attractive. But we definitely need more housing in the state of Iowa. That plays into this conversation. I think we're meeting our targets, and you see that locally as well as statewide, that you're seeing a lot of action happening with new housing, and I'm excited to see that. A lot of that is due to the workforce housing tax credit, and I'm an advocate for expanding that because it's working, and that's also helping rural Iowa. I think Ogden has done a fabulous job too, taking advantage of those. So,
Well, the one thing I kind of want to get, because I will tie it into a little bit on regulatory reform and stuff like that. doing some things like that? Is that going to be taking a look at some of the regulations that are in place? Obviously, you need some for some control, but enhancing opportunities for businesses to come here, things like that.
Well, I'm not sure what's coming down the pipeline as far as conversations, but the one thing's for sure, I think things are working. I mean, that was incredible news with Daisy. That was unfortunate with Tyson, but I've heard some dribblings of rumors that somebody's going to come into Tyson, but I think Margaret's right too. When we're giving incentives to some of these companies, there should be some expectations that if there is a closure, maybe that. As far as like deed restrictions or whatever, to that they can't forbid selling that property to a like business.
Okay.
That's in their sure. Wheelhouse. So, nevertheless, I think things are working, and we need to continue doing what we're doing.
I'd like to see, with economic development, I would like to see us go down to smaller communities, have some programs for them, some grant opportunities. You know, I know a lot of people little communities can't do matching funds. You know, if you have a population of 300 people, you don't have the dollars there. You're probably fortunate if you can keep your, you know, library going and your well, I know a lot of communities share a sewer plant.
Sure.
Superintendents. I would really like to see us do more in the smaller communities. And also, you know, having a robust public school helps these communities thrive.
Okay, got some big things to hit on here because I don't want to run out of time, but let's talk about, let's talk about Right to Life. The bill, the Supreme Court did make their ruling. The Iowa Supreme Court did make their ruling on our heartbeat law. Are you comfortable where it's at, Jesse? Do you think more changes need to be made? What are you looking?
Well, I think we're having a healthier system where states can wrestle this out and with themselves in their own constitutions. I think having a blanket policy across the nation isn't healthy. We are at the laboratory of the states, and when you take a sensitive topic like this, I think we're having a healthier conversation now. Lawmakers need to wrestle with these sensitive issues. That's what we were elected to do. And so one thing with the heartbeat bill is I like how it brings compassion back into the conversation. If the end of life starts with a heartbeat, why not the beginning of life? And instead of having like a 6-week ban or a 20-week ban or something that's time frame, let's bring the humanity back into this conversation. And so with our exemptions in place, I think we're starting to get close to a policy that most of society can come to grips with. You know, when I hear Democrats talk about this issue, rarely do they talk about the exemptions. And so the public, as they get more informed about what our law actually is, I think they're starting to distrust the Democrat Party as to their opinions on this, because let's have an honest conversation about what the bill actually is. The bill exempts rape, incest, and health of the mother. And so let's... if we need to tweak some of the exemptions going forward, then maybe let's have that conversation. But this huge, drastic swing back and forth in policy is not healthy for our society on this sensitive conversation. And one thing I've noticed from the Democrat Party is very few in the Democrat Party can really nail down as to what is acceptable. I've heard some people say that life begins at first breath and whatever. Does that mean that abortion it should be legal up to first breath? I mean, I think most of our society wouldn't agree with that. Also, I think most of our society agrees that abortion should not be used as a contraceptive. And so that's what we're trying to eliminate is that. I was proud to vote for more access to contraceptives. I think we have more education now than we ever have before. And so those are all good things. We're supporting the mother. We increase our postpartum coverage for Medicaid. And so I think we're definitely moving in a healthier direction in the state of Iowa.
Margaret,
right.
Having been in healthcare.
Yes, and in my time as an operating room nurse, I never saw abortion used as a preventative or a contraceptive. Yes, I never saw that. This is a very personal decision. It's you're deciding for a person what they can and cannot do with their body. I don't think that's right. We have politicians making legislation, laws, that they're not qualified. Where's your medical background in this? I just don't agree. No one should be telling a woman what they can do or can't do with their body. As far as the,
the exemption part?
The exemptions.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's confusing. The medical board has not laid out clearly what are the boundaries for our physicians. Well, that's wrong. Give them their guidelines. Let them know what the consequences are, or if there's any. And I think it's a shame that we have medical doctors that have spent years going to school. You know, it used to be you had general practitioners delivering your babies.
Mm-hmm.
We have advanced through time to specialists, which is great because a pregnancy can be very challenging. You know, there's health risks with it.
Sure.
Always. And you may think you're a healthy person, and you may have high blood pressure with it. And that has to be watched very carefully.
The only thing I would add to that, and I'm curious Margaret's opinion on this, is the penalties and the rules around the exemptions, it's all with the Board of Medicine. So it's not a politician that's coming in and penalizing the doctors and whatnot. This is self-regulated within the medical community. And that also gets lost in this conversation. And so I trust the doctors to come up with the right rules and penalties as they approach this legislation.
Okay. Well, I don't think they should be penalized for doing their job and caring for their patients. I have been in surgery and experienced watching a surgeon hesitant, and this was years ago. And unfortunately, the patient was the one that ended up never ever being able to have a child because of the hesitancy of what would have been a simple DNC turned into a hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate. I do think there's a lot of rhetoric around, when a late term abortion. I don't feel that that's an abortion. Something is terribly wrong either with the mother or the baby. I don't know any woman that carries a baby for 8-9 months and then decides they don't want that baby. That's just not true. There's something medically wrong, and that is a very hard decision for a family to make. It's gut-wrenching. And as far as, well, we won't go to the other rhetoric. It really has to be a woman's choice.
Here's one I know you guys both agree on. Eminent domain in the case of Summit. We'll go, well, eminent domain, period. I'll go with Jesse first.
Well, I'm not sure if we'll 100% agree on this or not, because it's way more complicated than there's so many rabbit trails that you can go down with this. There's many different opinions, many different concerns. I mean, you have the climate change concerns that this is where this originated. You know, some people are trying to address climate change through this. And then you have the big business community that's they see a problem that, that they think that they can help fix, but also make money on. And then you have the property owners. And so each one has legitimate concerns as they approach this conversation. But no doubt about it is kind of like when Roe versus Wade first came into place in the 70s, it created this kind of concerning time within America for decades as far as like abortion rights. But the same thing with Kelo happened roughly 20 years ago, where it said that private use of eminent domain is okay for economic development purposes. And so within that framework, you had the Supreme Court that was divided on that issue. And so you've had this tension within our society ever since. And now Iowa is facing this project front and center, and we're trying to address that conversation. That's why I signed on to a lawsuit. I think we need to overturn that Kelo decision. So then we can have a healthier conversation about when eminent domain should be okay. But one thing's for sure is that you have two different opinions, as well as from the landowners that are on the pipeline versus the landowners that are around the pipeline. So if you polled our district, I guarantee you 90% of people would be against this project in some way, shape, or form. That's the bottom line. And so I got to be a voice for that, and that's why I've done the best that I can to be a voice for that. Lastly, we cannot forget about the economic concerns with this. Ethanol can potentially be a solution to the climate change conversation, especially if we lower the carbon intensity score of that fuel. That's what the pipeline is supposed to do, is lower the carbon intensity score to that. But can we do better when it comes to private property rights? If somebody doesn't want the pipeline going through their project, why not go down the ditch? And so, there's other ways to alleviate those concerns. South Dakota, that's what they're doing up there, is they're having to reroute the project. And so I'm actually going to have a bill that's going to be public. Thomas Lane, the county attorney from Greene County, has written it for me. And hopefully before session starts, I'm going to get co-sponsors. And I want us to rally around one bill that addresses these projects going forward so that we have more clarity on this issue.
All right. Margaret, your thoughts?
Well, there was a bill that the House passed, and it just got lost or buried in the Senate. My understanding is Jesse Musur with Sierra Club did come talk to Jesse about the bill, and he said that he would, if it didn't surface, I'm paraphrasing, that he would go get the bill and work with it. That did not happen. Yes, I believe that you work hard to own your land, and I'm fine with public use. But when you're going to go in and disturb, you know, a farmer's land, no. And this is not for public good, in my opinion. Summit is a for-profit company. I think we need to have a water study. If they're going to consume that much water annually, we don't know how much is down in our aquifer. We need to know. I think that's utmost important, especially with climate change. We don't want to run out of water. Also, Summit will not release the plume studies. Security. How are first responders supposed to manage that if they don't know what they're dealing with? Also, a lot of communities don't have first responders or the fire departments. Some cities, the fire departments are not leaving their city limits. So where does that leave these smaller communities? Also, I don't know what is their education for these first responders, firemen. I think there's a lot more than they realize.
At this point,
could I address the point that she made? So one thing about what I said I would and would not do as chairman of a local government committee, one thing's for sure is the House did pass over multiple bills. It wasn't just one. But the one that I felt had a lot of legitimacy was a 90% bill that would require 90% voluntary easements in order for eminent domain to be granted. Here's the problem with that is, one is they will get to 90%. So then you're still going to have an angry group of people that don't want the pipeline. And so is it really getting at the heart of the issue? And that's why I'm excited about this lawsuit that I signed on to. It's getting to the heart of the issue and having a constitutional question about the legitimacy of this project. So that's one angle I took on that. The reason I didn't share that with the lobbyist down there at the Sierra Club is throughout session last year, she was actually pro-choice advocates were utilizing her to get to me to yell at me about pro-choice stuff and abortion stuff. And I felt that was disrespectful to me. And that's why I quit sharing information with her from that point going forward last session. The other part of it is I am chairman of local government. I want to be a responsible chair. It was very clear that pipeline bills were going to go through Commerce last year, and I wanted to be respectful to the process. That chairman did not agree with any of the pipeline bills. He has since resigned. I couldn't imagine the pressure that he went through. I mean, it was kind of a shocking development. He won his primary, went through a tough primary, and then he decided to leave the Senate. So I'm not sure what the future holds with that. But I think because I've done a good job representing my people, being a good voice for my people, being a good chairman for my local government committee, I think I did the I have put my constituency in a good spot to have a good voice going forward, and that's why I think I'm best placed to have this conversation. Lastly, I am a property owner. I've dealt with fence disputes, windmill disputes, drainage disputes. I've been on drainage commission boards. I've dealt with all this, so I think in the Senate, I'm actually one of the best voices on this topic.
We are out of time. And so what I want you to do, Margaret, could you give me a little wrap-up and how people can find out more about your campaign, maybe visit with you?
Oh, yes. You can reach or contact me through Listen for Iowa. Also, I'm on Facebook. Yes, and on my webpage, you can go and send me a message, and that comes directly to me, and I can answer it. Actually, when I've gotten them, I've answered them rather quickly.
And still a lot of campaigning to do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
All right. Jesse, what about you?
Yeah, so my cell phone number is 515-351-9761. Just give me a call. The emails, I've over the last 4 years, I've gotten over 10,000 emails, so I get desensitized to that. So the best thing to do, and it's kind of hard. I mean, sometimes you don't know who's a constituent, who's not. If you do email me, make sure you list where you're from, and I guarantee you'll get a response if you do that. I look forward to the election coming. I want to thank Margaret. She's been, I think she is a genuine public servant. She's treated me well with respect. And so it's been a good campaign. So right. Thank you.
And Jesse has done the same.
Thank you very much for both joining us today. And good luck in the election coming up on November 5th.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Jim.
Thank you.